Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Sarah Thompson, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. The 2023 International Consensus Recommendations for Use of Prolonged Infusion Beta-Lactam Antibiotics suggest that prolonged infusions may lead to better outcomes in specific patient populations. Recent studies have shown variable efficacy and safety with the use of prolonged and continuous infusions for the treatment of sepsis and septic shock. Let's listen in as pharmacist Michaela Warfield reviews literature comparing the use of intermittent and prolonged infusion strategies with beta-lactam therapy in the critically ill patient.
In the realm of critical care, the statistics are sobering, knowing that up to 1 in 4 patients faces a life-threatening battle with infections, underscoring the importance of antibiotics in their use. Given that guidelines have always given the recommendation to optimize antibiotic use, but give no reason or way to go about this, it is important for us to consider how we can appropriately use the antibiotics that we have today to provide better outcomes for our patients. Today, I want to cover 3 different objectives, with the first being describing the pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic considerations to look at with our critically ill patients. Additionally, we will review different primary literature and the different strengths and limitations that we have for the literature available, and then identify clinical situations that are appropriate to use prolonged infusion beta-lactam therapy. Starting right in with sepsis and septic shock, based on the World Health Organization, there are 48.9 million cases of sepsis annually. Additionally, there's 11 million sepsis-related deaths worldwide. The mortality rate for these different disease states include 20% for sepsis and 69% for septic shock. With the literature that we have available right now, we know that there are 3 different things that can improve outcomes for our patients, those 3 being fluids, antibiotics, and vasopressors. Today, our conversation will revolve around antibiotics. Antibiotics, specifically with beta-lactams, they account for 2/3 of injectable antibiotic scripts within the United States on an annual basis. We know that this is the backbone of sepsis and septic shock therapy, so we know that we have to use these appropriately to adequately treat infections in these patients. Additionally, we have microbial resistance that is among the top 10 threats to global health based on the World Health Organization. In order to help manage the resistance and rising MIC levels that we have, we know that we need to be good stewards with the antibiotics that we have available. Beta-lactams demonstrate a time-dependent killing, meaning that we need to optimize the time above the minimum inhibitory concentration, or MIC, as I'll refer to it for the remainder of this presentation. Looking at the dose concentration curve that we have here, we need to optimize that time in the yellow, or the time above MIC. Based on the recommendations that we have today, standard and extended infusions are recommended to hit 50 to 70% time above MIC, whereas continuous infusions, we target 100% time above the MIC. We have various different infusion strategies available to use our antibiotics, and specifically beta-lactams, with the first being intermittent infusions. Based on this scheme here, you can see that we get high peaks, which are then cleared from the body and then go below the MIC value. Knowing that we want to target the 50 to 70% above MIC, there are other additional infusion strategies that we can utilize. With extended infusions, you can see that there is a little bit improvement in that time above MIC, given that extended infusions are given over 3 to 4 hours. Additionally, we have continuous infusions, but you can see that time above MIC improves again with this strategy. But knowing that we have different strategies, why do we care about this if we've always done studies that show intermittent infusions are helping? If we focus on the considerations in our critically ill patients, we can see that there are a lot of different pharmacokinetic changes that happen within this patient population. In sepsis and septic shock, we see increased permeability of our vasculature, which causes an increase in volume of distribution. As we administer fluids as one of the different strategies we know that improve outcomes, this increase in volume of distribution additionally increases and causes a lower plasma concentration in our hydrophilic drugs, or beta-lactams, for example. We also see a decrease in albumin levels, which inhibits that protein binding, allowing for more drug to leave the body and leave that site of infection where we want it to treat. We also have an increased cardiac output as a compensatory response when we administer fluids and when they present with sepsis or septic shock. There's an increase in renal and hepatic blood flow as a result of this compensatory response, which then also causes increased renal clearance and hepatic metabolism. All of these together cause lower plasma concentrations. If we go back to our drug concentration curve, and for example, we can use piperacillin tazobactam, when they present with sepsis and septic shock, if we're using this antibiotic, with that increased volume and distribution with piperacillin tazobactam, which is hydrophilic, we see a decrease in that time above MIC. Additionally, with the decrease in albumin levels, we see another drop in that drug concentration at the site of infection. As the renal and hepatic metabolism and clearance increases, we also see that decrease in time above MIC. Knowing that our target is 50 to 70% above that MIC value, with this curve and the decrease that we see with these different instances, that is not adequately treating our infection. So we need to consider how we can use antibiotics to improve this. With that, that brings us to our first audience question. So which of the following is a pharmacokinetic change that may alter beta-lactam concentrations in patients experiencing early phases of septic shock? We have question A, which is an increase in volume distribution. Answer B, a decrease in hepatic clearance. C, an increase in albumin levels. Or D, a decrease in renal blood flow. And I'll give you a moment to think about that. Okay, so I see answers slowing down, and I would agree with the majority in this situation. So A, increase in volume and distribution would be the correct answer. So as we talked about, with that increase in volume and distribution, we see decreased plasma levels. With B and D, these are incorrect because it would be an increase in hepatic clearance and an increase in renal blood flow, also causing decreases in the plasma concentration. And then answer C, an increase in albumin levels, is incorrect because it would be a decrease, which then causes lower protein binding and lower plasma concentrations. But now that we talked about different infusion strategies and what this might look like in our critically ill patients, what does this mean as far as our literature that's available? So the first study that I want to look at is a hypothesis generating study. So this was a study that was conducted back in 2007. With the objective looking at difference in 14-day mortality for patients that were receiving extended infusion, piperacillin tazobactam, versus intermittent infusions. So there were 194 patients that had positive Pseudomonas and were receiving piperacillin tazobactam. Their outcome was looking at the difference in 14-day mortality, and as you can see, there's a 21.55% mortality versus a 5.2% mortality in favor of using extended infusions. The part that I want to focus on, however, is their stratified outcome, where they pieced out different mortality levels in patients that had an Apache 2 score less than 17 versus an Apache 2 score greater than 17. You can see in those with a lower than 17 score, they are less severely ill and they don't have as big of a difference or any statistical difference in the amount of mortality that was experienced. When you look at more severely ill patients or those with an Apache 2 score greater than 17, this is where it became statistically significant in favor of using extended infusions. As a result of this study and many other studies that followed, we had new consensus recommendations that were released in August of this year. The authors of these recommendations addressed 12 different PICO questions, and one that I wanted to piece out and look at was whether or not we should be using prolonged infusion beta-lactams over standard infusions in severely ill adult patients. The authors had a 17-0 vote in favor of using prolonged infusion beta-lactams over those with intermittent infusions. And I do want to pull out one piece where they use the definition prolonged infusion. So prolonged infusion is encompassing of both extended and continuous infusions, with extended being those given over 3 to 4 hours and continuous infusions lasting over the 24 hours of the day. And then these were compared to intermittent infusions, which are given over 30 to 60 minutes, which we might be a little bit more familiar with in our practice. Based on the studies that were included in these recommendations, they gave a mortality forest plot looking at why they did recommend using prolonged infusions. So you can see here that there were multiple studies but I do want to give the caveat that our presentation today focuses more on extended infusions, and only 4 of the studies included in this forest plot looked at extended, whereas the rest of them looked at continuous infusions, which is not as common in our practice here at Mayo Clinic. The first study by Ahmed and colleagues was one that compared severe sepsis or septic shock patients who received intermittent infusion meropenem versus extended infusion. So they had 148 patients who were admitted to the MICU with severe sepsis or septic shock. While we don't use severe sepsis as a definition today, while they were conducting their study, this was a definition and was appropriately used to determine how severely ill these patients were. The treatment arms are listed below in the table with intermittent infusion and extended infusion dosing. The intermittent infusion was done earlier before the protocol was implemented and therefore had guidance to give different dosing based on the BMI level and renal function. Whereas after the protocol was implemented, we can see extended infusion did not have any difference for the BMI levels. The severity of illness for these patients included the Apache 2 score of 18 or 19 for the different groups, and then the SOFA score of 5 or 6. This Apache 2 score with 18 and 19 in the groups did meet that cutoff of 17 based on our hypothesis generating question. And then the infection types are listed below, with the most common being respiratory and the second most being bacteremia. I included this just because I thought it was a great representation of what we would see in practice today, with the most common being respiratory. And then a high number do have unknown infection type, which is relevant because a lot of times we don't have a source of infection for our patients that come in with sepsis or septic shock. They looked at a few different outcomes, with the primary outcome being ICU mortality. And as you can see, extended infusion was favorable with a statistically significant difference in ICU mortality. For their secondary outcomes, they had a handful of different outcomes, with the first being clinical response. And this was based on temperature, their white blood cell count, discontinuation of vasopressors, and discontinuation of mechanical ventilation. And there was a statistically significant difference with clinical response for the extended infusion group. They also looked at microbiological response, and this was based on clearance of their cultures, but only 48 patients of the 148 included in this study had culture data at the end of their infusions that were able to be included in this outcome. They also looked at white blood cell count normalization, which was in favor of the extended infusion, and then days on vasopressors, which also had a favoritism towards that extended infusion. But you might say, well, how do we evaluate this study? What are the strengths and limitations? So the strengths were that they did have minimal exclusion criteria, making this widely applicable to our patients. They also had a clearly defined protocol, so this makes it easy for us to know what they administered and how we can utilize this in our patients here. And then it was one of the largest studies focusing on extended infusions in the critically ill at the time of their publication. Some limitations, however, were that they did allow for concomitant antimicrobial therapy. However, there was no difference amongst groups with the intermittent or extended infusion based on any of the antibiotic classes. There was a little bit of variability in the total daily dosing between groups, with this likely being related to that cutoff of the BMI that I described earlier, where intermittent infusion patients did have different dosing based on the BMI cutoff and renal function, whereas extended infusion did not after their protocol was implemented. They also do not have therapeutic drug monitoring reported, which makes it hard for us to know whether they hit that 50 to 70% time above MIC that we discussed earlier. Overall, the conclusion did suggest that there was lower rates of ICU mortality when using an extended infusion versus intermittent infusion of meropenem. However, meropenem is not always the antibiotic that we use in these cases, given that it is restricted here at Mayo Clinic. So other antibiotics that were included, I did want to look at as well. So we have another study by Richter and colleagues. This was a retrospective before and after study. They also used extended infusion and intermittent infusion, and they have different antibiotics included. So they used piperacillin tazobactam, meropenem, and inupenem. These were the most common. However, they did have other beta-lactams included as well. They had a protocol where there was a specified time from 2015 to 2017 where they used intermittent infusion, and then from 2017 to 2020, they use extended infusion. One difference that I do want to point out is the patient populations. So the intermittent infusion only had 124 patients, whereas the extended infusion had 290. Based on this difference, it's hard to sometimes draw conclusions because they're not balanced amongst groups. So they did do propensity score matching, They did this based on age, sex, SOFA score, and VIS score, the vasoactive inotropic score. And the only difference amongst groups after matching was the SOFA score. However, while there was a statistical difference, I do want to say that their SOFA scores were higher in this study in general, based on our previous study that was 5 or 6. So while it is different, they are still critically ill. Based on their raw data and the non-matched outcomes, we can see that there was statistical difference in all of the outcomes that they looked at, including hospital mortality, ICU mortality, and 30 and 90 day mortality. However, when they did the propensity score matching, we can see that there were no statistical differences amongst the groups. When looking at the bar chart, however, we can see that there was a trend towards lower rates of mortality with the extended infusion versus the intermittent infusion. Strengths and limitations, again, of this study include they did perform propensity score matching, so this made it helpful to know what the outcomes are when we match the baseline data of the different groups together. They also did not exclude any patients that needed temporal renal replacement therapy, whereas the first study did exclude renal replacement therapy, but not renal dysfunction. They also had minimal other exclusion criteria, making this widely applicable to our patients. Some limitations, however, it was monocentric, so while it's only done at one institution, it might be harder to know whether this is appropriate at our institution. They didn't have MIC data available again, so we don't know if they hit that 50 to 70% time above MIC that we're targeting with our different beta lactams. And then dose adjustments were listed as standard guideline dosing. So while we have the standard infusion that they use for higher renal function, those that needed renal dose adjustments were just listed as standard rather than actually giving the specific dose that they gave. They also had concomitant antimicrobials and antivirals, which again were not different amongst the groups, but it is important to consider. So while there were no statistical differences based on their score matching, there was still a trend towards a decreased mortality rate based on using extended infusion over those that were receiving intermittent infusion based on this study. Now that we covered two different studies looking at extended infusions, they are a little bit smaller studies, so I think it's important to consider some of the meta-analyses that are available. And specifically, the Rhodes and colleagues study meta-analysis looked at 18 different trials, with 9 of them being based on continuous infusions and 9 looking at extended infusions. So this study covered over 3,400 patients across those 18 different trials, and they looked at the use of piperacillin tazobactam on severely ill patients as compared to those that were getting intermittent infusions. The outcomes that they looked at are fourfold. So you can see the number of studies included in each of these outcomes. So clinical cure, again, was based on the same data that was available in the last one with temperature, white blood cell count, and then discontinuation of vasopressors. This was statistically significant in addition to the microbiological cure, however, only included 4 of the 18 studies. The hospital length of stay and ICU length of stay both were not statistically significant. However, I think it's important to consider, were these outcomes clinically significant? So again, the top two are clinically significant. And then hospital length of stay, while it's not statistically significant, so we can't definitely say that there was a difference of 2 days, it does appear that there's a trend towards shorter hospital lengths of stays when using the prolonged infusion versus intermittent infusion. ICU length of stay, this one is questionable because we don't necessarily know what the difference was, although it does seem like there is a trend towards shorter ICU lengths of stay. And now we've covered a lot of different data, and we have the recommendations that were released recently, but the most recent trial, which is called the MERCY trial, was not included in those recommendations because it was published after the time of the release. So the MERCY trial specifically is looking at continuous infusions, so not any prolonged infusion, just continuous. And they looked at administration of meropenem compared to those with intermittent administration. The population included in this were 607 different patients across 31 different ICUs in 4 different countries. Based on this, this mean SOFA score was 9 and a SAP score was 44. So they don't have an APACHE score for this patient population, but a SAP score of 44 is approximately the same as the APACHE score greater than 17. The different infusion types are listed there, with continuous being 3 grams over 24 hours and then 1 gram over 30 to 60 minutes every 8 hours, which is the same as what we would do in our practice here. The renal dose adjustment is also listed there for your reference. The primary outcome that they looked at for this study was composite all-cause mortality at 28 days and emergence of pan-drug resistance. And this composite outcome was not statistically significant. And then when looking at the individual outcomes alone, again, were not statistically significant. Their secondary outcomes include alive and antibiotic-free days, alive and ICU-free days at 28 days, and then the 90-day mortality, none of which were clinically or statistically significant. But you might ask, now we have a lot of data saying that prolonged infusions are beneficial. Why did this study come out after the recommendations saying that we should use prolonged infusions in our severely ill patients, but this one does not show the same results? So looking at some of the strengths and limitations as to why this might be, it was the largest study at the time looking at continuous infusion meropenem. They also had a strict protocol, making it easier to know how they were administering medications and how we should do it here. And then it was the largest multi-center study across multiple institutions, ICUs, and countries, which we didn't have much of at the time of the consensus recommendations. The limitations were that they included mostly patients that had experienced hospital onset sepsis. So this is important just because hospital onset sepsis is harder to recognize. And we know based on the surviving sepsis campaigns that we need to get antibiotics on board rapidly. And if we're not able to identify that they have sepsis, we might not get antibiotics started in a timely fashion. They also had patients that received antibiotic therapy within 3 months, which is one of the risk factors for more drug-resistant organisms. So the fact that majority of patients had had antibiotics recently makes it harder to treat because we do have some of those more resistant bugs. They also had a failure to meet power to detect a difference in the primary composite outcome. So while they didn't meet power, it's hard to know whether that outcome is actually relevant because they did not meet power. The conclusion of this study was that in critically ill patients with sepsis or septic shock, the continuous administration of meropenem did not lead to lower rates of mortality or emergence of pan-drug resistance compared to those that were receiving intermittent administration. So while I've covered a lot of different literature, I thought it was helpful to do a summary table to compare apples to apples amongst these studies. So based on the Ahmed and colleagues, the Richter study with the propensity score matching outcomes, and then our Rhodes meta-analysis and the Mercy trial, we can see the different patient populations that were included in each of these. The severity of illness, again, with that Apache score greater than 17 being our cutoff based on our hypothesis generating study, we had very severely ill patients in all of these studies. The antibiotics that were a focus in each of these included meropenem, piperacillin tazobactam, and imipenem. The infusion types are listed there with extended infusion versus intermittent infusion or continuous infusion. And then the only significant outcomes that we found based on these studies were in the Ahmed and colleagues, they saw a decrease in ICU mortality. And then with the Rhodes meta-analysis, we saw an increase in clinical cure and microbiological cure. So based on what we've covered, we have assessment question 2. So patient KM is a 64-year-old male admitted to the MICU for septic shock. His past medical history includes type 2 diabetes, HFpEF, and CKD3B. He has a BMI of 27, a temperature of 39, and a lactate of 3.2. His calculated Apache 2 score is 20 and a SOFA score of 6. The team is planning to initiate antibiotics, and given what you know, would you recommend the use of a prolonged infusion for this patient? You can use the arrow here to place a pin on where your comfortability or preference would be versus intermittent infusion or a prolonged infusion. Okay, so I see a variety of answers here. And I do think this is a bit of a gray area. So based on our patient, there's a few considerations that we might have. So if they presented with septic shock, we know that there's those pharmacokinetic changes that we discussed earlier with the increased volume of distribution, the increased renal and hepatic clearance, and then decreased albumin levels, which might impact our dosing of our antibiotics. Additionally, he had a SOFA score and an Apache 2 score available showing the severity of illness, which we need to consider when determining whether or not to use a prolonged infusion. But how exactly do we apply this and how do we know whether it's appropriate to use a prolonged infusion? There's a few different pieces that I want to cover, with the first being how to define critically ill. So one step to consider is what the severity of illness is. Again, looking at the Apache 2 score or the SOFA score, if you have those available, those are a good way to determine whether or not we can use a prolonged infusion. Say the patient is decompensating rapidly or they're doing well. This is one way to just clinically assess how our patient is doing. Additionally, we have the pharmacokinetic changes to consider. So if they have an increased volume of distribution based on what their presenting diagnosis is, we can determine whether or not we should be using a prolonged infusion based on all of those pharmacokinetic changes we covered. We also have the impact of antibiotics. So if a patient is presenting with septic shock, we know that we need to get antibiotics on rapidly based on the surviving sepsis campaign. Whereas if the patient is otherwise stable and just needs antibiotics for an infection, it might not be as relevant to get the antibiotics on rapidly. Another question to think about is what the role in obesity is. So we have patients that present with obesity. And this was actually a PICO question that the authors of the consensus recommendations tried to answer. And they actually did not give a recommendation for or against the use of prolonged infusions. But while we don't necessarily have recommendations from them, I think we can use our clinical judgment and determine if it's appropriate to use a prolonged infusion. Some pieces to consider are the degree and impact of underdosing. So if their obesity is, say, they have a BMI of 30 and they would be okay with standard dosing, maybe we don't need to use a prolonged infusion. Versus if the patient has a BMI of 60 and we know if we give them the standard dose, we probably aren't getting concentrations at that site of infection that are adequate to treat what is happening. Additionally, we don't have standard guidance or on the magnitude of dose increase that we need to give. So we need to consider what dose is appropriate based on the degree of obesity and what we're actually treating. Prolonged infusions could also play a role in avoidance of toxicity. So again, if we reflect back on the intermittent infusion strategy, we saw those high peaks, which then are cleared out from the body and go below that MIC value. If we give an adequate dose in a patient with a BMI of 60, this could be an even higher peak, causing toxicity to either their kidneys or their liver. We also have resistant concerns. So looking back at the antimicrobial resistance being among the top 10 threats to global health, it's important to ensure that we're using our antibiotics appropriately and assessing what the severity or susceptibility of those bugs are. When we look at the different infusion strategies, we can see the MIC value here. But as resistance and MIC values are rising, we can see that now that time above MIC is not adequate to treat the infection. Again, with more resistance, we can see another increase in the MIC, and these strategies are not adequate to treat that infection and get an adequate time above MIC that we're targeting for these patients. There's also drawbacks and other considerations to look at with prolonged infusions. So I know we've given a lot of data in favor of using a prolonged infusion, but what are other considerations to look at? So we have logistics of line access. So if we're going to give an infusion over 3 to 4 hours or a continuous infusion over 24 hours, we need to make sure that we have line access for those patients. Longer infusion times can also add challenges with scheduling of appointments or going to procedures or going down for imaging. If we have an infusion running, this is something we need to consider as we're transporting patients and getting them in machines to get appropriate imaging for them. There's also the safety concerns. So there's stability concerns with different formulations of beta-lactams. So for example, meropenem is not stable for as long as some of our other antibiotics. So we need to consider this and what infusion strategy we're using in order to make sure that it is stable for the amount of time that they need to use it. Compatibility is also something to be aware of, as if we're giving an infusion over 3 to 4 hours, other medications will have to be given during that time too. So making sure if we only have one line, is it compatible with other medications that are being administered? And then personnel, while this is not an exhaustive list by any means, we have nursing, which increases their complexity and workload if we're giving prolonged infusions. We also have pharmacy, which we have to consider again, that stability and the sterility of our compounds. If we have an infusion that's only stable for a few hours, then we'll have to consider when are we going to compound this so that it's ready and stable for when the nurse needs it, but that it's not unstable at the time of administration. Some future recommendations and studies that are also coming out in this area include the BLING-3 trial. So the BLING-3 trial is set to enroll over 3,000 patients. While this study is specifically looking at continuous infusion, it is helpful to know that they have a high enrollment because we can potentially draw some subpopulation results from this study. We have some patient populations that are not well represented in the studies that we have available based on the number of patients enrolled. So given the BLING-3 trial, when it gets published, we might be able to draw some other conclusions. We also have consensus statements that, although I didn't cover therapeutic drug monitoring specifically within this presentation, the authors of the consensus recommendations that came out in August of this year are working on a different consensus statement covering the therapeutic drug monitoring of beta-lactams. And this is set to publish at the end of 2024 or the beginning of 2025. And we've covered a lot of information, but I think it's important to know what we do here right now at Mayo Clinic when it comes to prolonged infusions. So we have a few different indications, with the first being critically ill ICU patients with severe infection or septic shock. This is a lot of what I covered today, and we discussed a lot of the roles within this patient population for prolonged infusions. Another indication includes patients with systemic infection and pathogens with higher MICs, or those that are not completely susceptible. So considering the different infusion types and that rising MIC value, what is the time above MIC going to look like if we give an intermittent infusion for a bug that might only be intermediately susceptible? And then last, we have critical ill patients with altered pharmacokinetics consisting of high volumes of distribution and augmented clearance. So that high volume of distribution we discussed with our obese patients, as well as those presenting with sepsis or septic shock, as we're administering fluids with their increased permeability, you can see the fluids leaving and the drug leaving as well in that increased volume of distribution. With augmented clearance, this really comes into play with those patients that have good renal function already. And then when they come in with sepsis or septic shock, they have augmented clearance, meaning that they're clearing drug even more rapidly than they would be otherwise. And so a prolonged infusion might be good for them in order to hit those adequate concentrations for adequate periods of time. The different dosing strategies are listed on the right-hand side there. While I won't cover them specifically, I do want to draw your attention to the loading dose, which is recommended through our institution for those receiving prolonged infusions. With that, that brings us to our last assessment question. So given the current literature available, which patient would it be most appropriate to prescribe a prolonged infusion beta-lactam? We have answer A, a 16-year-old 60-kilogram male with no past medical history admitted to the ICU for pneumonia. B, a 54-year-old 90-kilogram male with COPD admitted to the ICU for sepsis. C, a 70-year-old 220-kilogram female with diabetes admitted to the ICU for septic shock. Or D, a 65-year-old 90-kilogram male with dialysis-dependent CKD admitted to the ICU for catheter-related infection. Okay, so as the answers are slowing down, I would agree with the majority here, with C being the correct answer or the best answer. Well, I don't think there's only one correct answer. I think that C is most appropriate given the weight factor. So this patient is 220 kilograms, and as they're admitted for septic shock, we know that the mortality rate is higher in this patient population. So a prolonged infusion could be helpful given the increased volume of distribution based on their weight and their diagnosis. A would be incorrect because the 16-year-old 60-kilogram male admitted for pneumonia might not benefit from a prolonged infusion. Well, I think we could use one. I don't think we need to use prolonged infusions in all of our patients, and this might be one that it does not need to be used. For B, the 54-year-old admitted to the ICU for sepsis. Well, I do think we could use it in this patient. There isn't as strong of an indication as there is for C. We did cover sepsis and they're admitted to the ICU. We don't necessarily know how severely ill they are, but we know that antibiotics are appropriate. So we could go either for a prolonged infusion or an intermittent infusion. And then D is admitted to the ICU for catheter-related infection. I don't think that this is a strong indication to use a prolonged infusion because we could use our standard of therapy. And with that, we covered a few different things today. So the first takeaway I want to cover was that patients with critical illness, they do display a lot of different pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic changes that lead to lower plasma concentrations of beta-lactams. Studies also suggest that prolonged infusion beta-lactams may lead to better outcomes for select critically ill patients. It's important to consider the different patient-specific characteristics when determining whether or not we should be using a prolonged infusion, looking at things such as their illness, the comorbidities, and then the pharmacokinetic alterations.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.